Welcome to the Lighter Side of the Dark Side. It's your weekly freak show here on Renegade Radio and all podcast catchers, YouTube, Spotify, iHeartRadio, wherever you're listening to us, Apple. It's the Dark Mark. I am Dark Mark, the goth comedian, just recovered from my birthday and belly dancing and Thanksgiving. And as always, everybody's favorite horror writer, Nicole Sachs.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Nicole. It's early for you. I know that. It's kind of early for me. But we got a guy apparently connected with you on another podcast. Shame on you. But here he is. He's how dare you go on another podcast? But but he's very, very talented, very interesting. He's a master cinematographer, and he's done a lot of good stuff on that. I just watched his movie No Promised Land, which was very interesting. I was describing it to Nicole. She's very intrigued. And you have a movie coming up very soon. It's going to be in January on Gravitas Veritas, which is quite a step up for you, I think. It's definitely being distributed well. I just saw the coming attraction, the preview, and looks very interesting. Here he is, Colin Bressler.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Hi, Colin. Did I sum it up your career so far?
Yeah, pretty much.
Before we get started, I do have to say that we are being sponsored by Ray's Energy Drink. There it is, Ray's Energy Drink. I'm drinking it straight, so to speak. And Nicole is mixing hers with vodka, which it mixes well. This is the new juice box flavor, which is very juicy, very tasty.
Delicious.
Delicious. One of their wonderful, great flavors.
Mind if I try a little flavor, a little taste of that?
Yeah, you can have some of mine.
Yeah, of course. I want to see.
Oh, my God. He's actually going to drink it out of the can.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Take it in the can, but
you might get cooties, so we'll see what happens.
It's very good.
Yes.
I have to say, it's very, very tasty.
And the best part about it, zero calories, zero carbs, zero crash.
Very, very good.
And if, you know, they don't have it at 7-Elevens or grocery stores. They have it at GNCs and vitamin shops. And I know you're a big weightlifter, so you go to those places.
Sometimes, yes.
So, I mean, you not lately, but I understand. Yeah. But don't play full price. Go to the description in the podcast, wherever you're listening to us on podcasts, or on YouTube, and you'll get a link, 15% off a case of Ray's Energy Drink. You can get Juice Box, you can get the new ginger ale, you can get all sorts of great flavors. Baja Lime, it tastes like Baja Blast from Taco Bell.
Juice Box is great.
Yes.
You nailed it.
No, it's interesting because you're mainly known as a cinematographer, but now you're coming into your own as a writer and a director. Now, being an esteemed cinematographer, and we're going to get to some of your credits, and I know a couple of them are definitely going to intrigue Nicole, but is there a bias? Are there people that just think of you as a cinematographer and don't think of you as somebody that can write and direct?
Not really, because my cinematography work is mostly in sort of television and documentary world. Mm-hmm. So I used to shoot movies a long, long time ago. But because I don't shoot movies for a career and I mainly work in television and documentary, the movie world sort of, you know, I'm able to sort of wear different hats there and not be a big deal. But
that's good.
Yeah, like if I were to, I don't know, sort of try to direct a documentary or direct a docuseries on television, that's sort of like more like I think I'd get more stay in your lane kind of deal with that. Right. In that.
And speaking of that, I'm just reveling in the irony that my lighting is so poor and we have a cinematographer on because there's a big light shining through the window and I can't, it just throws through the slat in my, I just can't do it. Now, please, I'm glad I have you on because I'm always curious about this. What is cinematography? What do you do specifically? Because I always hear like, oh, the cinematography is great in this movie and the lighting, but you don't actually do the light. I don't know what do you do?
So, that's a great question. I mean, so basically if let's say a best way to describe it's like I get hired for a job and I'll get the script and the director will have brought me on. Generally, we know each other or whatever, but I get the script and sort of like my job is to sort of help get the director's vision through the camera to the screen. So like I'm the cinematographer is the director of the camera and lighting department. You're the boss, that what we would call for like department head. You're the department head of the camera and lighting department. And then there's subheads underneath you. But basically your job is lighting, right? You're the concepts of the lighting and the camera movement and camera work. But you don't.
What does the director do? I thought that's what the director did.
No, so the director is kind of like overall the overall massive vision of the entire project.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, I don't know, I've seen like Ridley Scott and people like that kind of talk about it as like they're the one that sort of like, they're almost like a therapist parent to all the other creatives, and they're the one kind of saying like, okay, no, that's too much red or whatever the thing is, and they're basically like in charge of the overall view. Now, of course, as any artist, some of them are more hands-on than others, right? Mm-hmm. Like some directors are more actors directors and they're more focused on directing actors. Some directors are more camera focused, so they're more interested in shots and how to design shots and all that stuff. So it's kind of like a mixed bag. But yeah, as a cinematographer, I come in and I'm focused on what kind of shots does the director want, and then what kind of lighting, what kind of vibe, what's the feeling of the movie, right?
Right.
And then I design that with the director, and we kind of come up with, but it's his or her medium. Like they're the director's the one that's saying like, this is what I want. So you're not coming up with it on your own per se. You're collaborating with the director on what visual style they want.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just go and do it.
Yeah. And then on set, you're there and you're the one, you know, overviewing everything, saying the light, you're calling out shots on the lighting. Your gaffer is your lighting director, is a, sort of the term. And that person's the one kind of executing their department, the lighting department, executing the process that you've already told them you want. Because it's all done in pre-production. The movie shoot itself is like, I don't know, it's just like execution of a sports play or something. It's like, you're just going at that point and you're just doing all the stuff you've already worked on in pre-production.
So if you could give me an example of, and just a personal opinion, and this might get you in trouble, but that's what we do here. What's an example of great cinematography and what's an example of horrible cinematography in your opinion? Because I got some examples.
So I'll tell you, it's funny. The other day I watched a movie called Insidious 1. The first one,
right?
And I thought that was horrible cinematography.
Why?
Everyone's gonna hate me.
No, that's okay. No, that's all right. It already made its money, so.
Well, I thought that the lighting, it was overlit a lot in the scenes. Mm-hmm. I thought that the lighting, I could tell it was shot on a stage. I don't know if it was. No, I might be correct on that. I believe it was. It looked like it was, and I felt like because it was shot on the stage, there were no ceilings, right? Because it's a studio. I felt like they overlit it, and in what they would call color grading, when they made the image the final look it had, I felt like they didn't bring it down enough. It just felt very lit to me, and I wasn't as scared as I wanted to be, if that makes sense.
So you saw too many things as they were happening when they should be in the shadows.
Yeah, I made a comment to my wife who was watching with me. I was like, I feel like I'm watching Friends, and I wasn't trying to be funny. It just like it felt. It just felt very like sitcom lighting, which is like we're taught sitcom lighting's like every ounce of it set is lit. You know, I prefer horror, like especially horror suspense. I want it to be dark shadows. You know, like I don't really want to see it a lot if I can. And in that movie, it also there was a zoom effect they kept using really for me as a cinema, like. It just took me. I was bothering me because it was every shot had a slight zoom in on it, and it was just kind of like I couldn't stop watching the zoom move anymore. Now that's a weird cinematography guy. Most people, fans, are going to be like, "What is he talking about?" That's just something I noticed, and I couldn't stop seeing it.
When you see like Brian De Palma movies or Coen Brothers movies where they're just whipping the camera around, do you think that's okay for that? You could bug with that too.
It depends on your exact example. I mean, the Coen brothers are their cinematographer is my favorite cinematographer. Right. He hasn't shot all of their films, but he shot most of them.
And I'm talking like the early ones, like Miller's Crossing and Raising Arizona, and you know, there's some movies where they go real nuts with it.
Yeah,
Adam's Family.
Yeah, Raising Arizona, I really liked because I thought I'd have to go watch it again for the lighting, but I thought the camera moves were absolutely amazing in that film. I thought, you know what it is? It's like the moves, if they're going to be over the top, they just got to fit the style and the feel of the movie. And mm-hmm. I just feel like bad cinematography is when it doesn't fit the style and the feel of the movie where you're like, I just feel like I'm starting to watch the cinematography. I'm not watching the movie anymore.
Right.
Great cinematography, I was thinking, Seven, a movie like Seven, I would say is
really
shot film, very moody. It the cinematography should kind of like put your brain into the mood they want
right.
you to be. It should at least accent that. And then the acting and the set design, all that stuff work together. But I feel like in Seven, the cinematography really gave me, I felt very claustrophobic and like mm-hmm. depressed. Watch, because it's raining and it's cold and everything's dark and miserable. And like,
right.
That's a success to me in that way.
That's what we try to achieve on this podcast. But I agree with you on Seven. And I think Seven might be probably the most influential cinematography movies cinematography wise, because every movie's trying to do that. And that's why I'm going to give you an example of bad cinematography. And my first example was Casino, because there was some weird, like, where they had just lights shining off the table as bright as this, and it's like it really distracted me, and I didn't really see why. Because Goodfellas is amazing cinematography, I think, because I didn't notice it, and then the cameras were just whipping around. But the one I could say was probably the worst cinematography I've seen, and I'm not a cinematographer, so I'm a comedian. What do I know? The Batman from last year was terrible. First off, it was too serious. I didn't like the movie at all. And I liked all the actors. The actors are great. I love Pattinson. I love them all. But it was just too slow. The cinematography, I couldn't see half of it. And I understand they're trying to go for, we're even darker than Christopher Nolan, but I'll just watch a black screen and that's all I need, you know?
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I mean, I like that film, but I think it was a little long, personally. That was my biggest issue, and I thought the third act was a little kind of strung along too long. It was kind of like, okay, I think we get it,
yeah.
Cinematography, I only seen it once, so I can't speak too intelligently on it. I saw it once in the theater. I didn't mind it, but I could see what your point about. There were definitely some dark scenes. I think they were going. It's hard because, you know, you remember I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones, but when everyone got pissed off about that one episode where it was really dark at night, it's like as a cinematographer, you're kind of like you're going into these things and you're like, okay, so Batman, we want to make it darker than Nolan's Batman. And we're going for this noir, really dark film noir vibe. So let's make it, you know, and I think that unless you kind of are able to reel yourself in or someone's able to reel you in, you might push it too far. Like you might go and then you get in the final release and you're like, oh, man, that's a little too much. So yeah, I mean it's a trick you have to sort of keep in mind, and you can easily go too far with it.
I mean to be a cinematographer nerd for a second. I mean, people used to call the cinematographer of The Godfather, Gordon Willis, the Prince of Darkness.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you see the Godfather movies compared to most movies now, it's like bright and sunny.
Yeah.
Right.
So weird, but
like everything's gotten that way too. I agree with you. Like a lot of films.
Over Thanksgiving, we were discussing Napoleon, which I really want to see. But one of the people there that was against seeing it was talking about the fact that they made it so gray and grainy. And he doesn't like that. He doesn't like the fact that he says they probably did it in order to hide the CGI use, but it's all made it kind of monotone. And he's like, Napoleon had really bright colors in real life. And he's like, when you see the costumes, they're all designed the way they're Napoleon Bonaparte in real life. But when you put that filter on them, then everything's just washed out. I still really want to see Napoleon, though. I love Joaquin Phoenix, and I love Ridley Scott.
So. It's playing at the Vista, so let me know, Nicole, if you want to see it. Because I haven't seen a movie in the Vista since it's reopened. I just reopened, so I'm looking forward to seeing it. Which is, I don't know if you know the Vista Theater. It's a theater walking distance from my house that's a big movie house, 400 seats. Quentin Tarantino bought it. So, but here's the thing. Now, looking at your cinematography credits, which are very impressive, especially as of late, you did cinematography on the PBS series Nova.
Yeah.
Now, was there CGI involved in that? There had to be, right?
In the Nova, yeah, they do. They do some renderings and like composite stuff like that. Yeah, of like it was about the JWT satellite, not satellite. What is it called? You know, the telescope.
Telescope, yeah.
Yeah.
Way into space. So we shot in a couple of the labs in Austin, Texas, place, you know, things like that. But all that they do recreations and some effect stuff to show, right, showcase what they're talking about. Because obviously some of the stuff they're talking about is not something you can physically show in real life, you know.
Now, are you involved in that CGI rendering or no?
No.
Okay.
Now, I go in, I shoot basically a raw image, and then I collect all that stuff, and then basically we send it off, and the editors and post-production team put it all together and make it into something.
And now this begs the question. Now, you were a cinematographer on film pre-CGI when you started, and now everything's digital CGI. How did you make the transition?
Yeah, that's an amazing question. I mean, it was really difficult, but I got lucky because I went to film school in the mid-90s and then got out of film school, and I was looking for work like everyone else does, and I started doing production assistant work in television because that was kind of like the burgeoning thing was reality television, like all this kind of like TV stuff was just starting back then. And I, you know, I got into that world, and that was video. So back then it was like video and film, and they were like polar opposites, nothing in common. Video used video cameras, but most importantly used what are called ENG lenses or the zoom lenses. But it was literally like two sides of your brain, you know, an artistic person and a mathematical person, right? And so they were very different. And I remember I first started out, it was really hard for me to make the to do any kind of video stuff as I was filming, doing film.
Right.
And as time went on, I kind of like learned the video end. And then as you were saying, my career was just getting off the ground in film and all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, hey, there's this thing called HD, digital HD. This is the future. And I had to kind of like learn that, but I had at least already had a video background that helped me kind of like make the transition over. Whereas if I was only film, I would have been really hard to make that transition over because it's a different brain. Like you really are thinking different. You have to think differently. You know?
Our prior sponsor, Tactical Soap. We are sponsored by Tactical Soap. Andrew, we are sponsored
by
Tactical Soap.
Don't drop it in the
prison. No. Tactical Soap is pheromone infused soap.
Really?
And Vanya, you know, you want a guy to smell good, don't you?
I sure do, because I like to eat him up.
Right. Well, you'll be eating this up because they have three variations of three different soaps.
Oh, okay.
Maverick. Bond and Durden.
Bond, that's for me.
And they have soaps.
Maverick.
James Bond.
Right. They have Maverick. Yeah, Bond is for the older men. And so, but they have three different variations of the soap. Great smelling. I'm waiting for myself to come. But they have soaps. They have deodorant. They have lotions. They have all sorts of stuff. Go to the description in this podcast and get your Tactical Soap.
Get your soap on.
Exactly.
Soapy.
And some people have been left behind. Now, are you one of these, as like, I know you do it because you have to work, but are you one of these guys like, damn it, the kids don't know. It's better on film without the CGI. Or you're like, no, it's because we had the, I don't mean to brag, but we had the independent filmmaker you've probably heard of and nobody else has heard that knows this podcast, Hal Hartley, on the podcast long time ago.
Wow.
And he had to transition to video, but he says it's so much better because now a movie that he'd have to get funding for $1 million for, he could do for $100,000. He does GoFundMe now for all his movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's a double-edged sword for me because on one hand, I am the old man, get off my lawn guy about film. I miss it. I love it. I think it separated the people who really knew what they were doing to the people who are trying to fake it, right? But the thing about digital is I wouldn't be here talking to you. You know, like if there wasn't digital, I would never have had access to make any of these films.
Right.
Because it's just like you said, like Hal Hartley said, it's so much cheaper. It's easier.
Right.
It's easier to edit.
Yeah, because
yeah,
think about
for sure.
When I was starting out, I would let's say I wanted to make, No Promised Land, right? I would have to go, well, is it going to be 16 millimeter or 35 millimeter, right? Then I thought, well, I would go with 16 millimeter because it's cheaper. So the, but then it's like, I got to, okay, I got what lab am I going to process the film in?
Right.
How much film am I going to buy? You know what I mean? Like those things I just mentioned would be like alone would be 40 times the budget of No Promised Land. Just that part. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Forget actors and like food cost and things like that. Like, so it's, I mean, what I've been able to do is only because of the digital cinema revolution. I wouldn't, there's no way I would maybe right. have made one movie, maybe if I was lucky, right. but probably not.
And before we get to your movies, cause they're all very interesting and you're really creating a niche as far as really like kind of psychological horror. But I do have to one more cinematographer credit. I didn't think we were going to talk me cinematography this long, but what are the cinematography challenges of filming My 600-Pound Life?
Oh my God.
Apparently there's a lot because you just chuckled. So I got to hear about this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, do you have a specific question? Cause I'll be honest with you.
Camera placement because the people are so huge. Getting the people around.
Well, I'll be honest. I probably shouldn't say this, but I will.
It's our show. Get people to say things they don't say normally.
The whole thing is that when you do a show like that, you're dealing with people that are not keeping their lives in order, right? So there's a lot of uncleanliness. I can't think of the word. There's a lot of stuff like that. There's mental illness factors that play into it where there's a lot of like really negative stuff. So honestly, like the filming wasn't very hard for me. It was, you know, when you go in, your mind kind of gets put in this place and you just sort of have to like, so I learned after the first few times I did it, I learned that, okay, you got to kind of check out.
Right.
You can't be invested. I was like, and it actually taught me a lot as a filmmaker, like, because I was like, okay, so some things you do, you have to be able to check out. Like, you got to be able to, like, take yourself out of it and just be a robot, a creative robot that's standing there filming and coming up with cool shots or something, but I can't be connected to anything I'm shooting. Like, I shot surgeries, flesh being ripped apart and stuff in front of me, blood everywhere. You know, I've shot, you know, people doing horrible things or like horrible. I was witness to family stuff that was really hard to deal. You know what I mean? But I just had to be like, okay, I'm separating myself. And also like I said, the smells and things like that would stick with you. I have facial hair. Like it would stay with you. So you get in a hotel every night and you're like, it's just there in your nose. And you're like, I remember being like, the hotel was, when you got back to the room most nights, it would be like this decompression moment of like, you know, take a shower and just try to like let go of everything from the day and hope for the best tomorrow, you know.
Right. You're on the road, so your wife wasn't with you, so that was probably good.
No, never. Yeah, never. I never actually worked locally for that show.
Right.
It was always on the road, all the way, you know, anywhere you would, you know, in the most ridiculous, like wherever, you know, random. The one thing on side note, I sociologically, I really enjoyed it because you got to see all disparate parts of this country. And I became sociological in my mind because I was like, oh, rural, this is what's happening in like rural Missouri and rural Alabama. Oh, this is what's happening in the city of blah, blah, blah. You know, you got to see like American life, and you'd go to like grocery shop stores and these random places that you'd never be in a million, you know, I don't know. It was kind of cool that way, but it was pretty hard.
That does sound cool.
But not clean. Cool, but not clean.
Like I said, we could do a whole another show where I could tell you they're horror stories. They're literally horror stories.
Well, I want to hear that, but I do have to get to your now. Why did you start directing? And I just saw your movie No Promised Land, which Nicole, very interesting. It's about a woman that gets involved with a married man, and basically, I shouldn't even say that because I already just gave some of it away, but she's in an Uber with her child, or you think it's an Uber. She's in a car with somebody with her child, and the story unfolds, and it's It's a Native American woman that gets involved with a white guy. So if you don't have 3 hours to see Killers of the Flower Moon, see No Promised Land. You can kind of get it. But I really love the editing in that because it was, to me, and I watch a lot more movies than I should. It was kind of a modern spin of what, say, Dennis Hopper was doing in the 60s, where he would go back and forth between the past and the future, but kind of glitchy and digital. I really liked it.
Thank you. Wow. That's high praise.
Am I off base?
Say again?
Am I off base? Was that an influence?
No. I probably somewhere. I mean, I know what you're referring to. I don't know. I mean, I think it was definitely an influence. I think that I wanted it to be – I knew that the story was small, right, in the basis of the story. So I knew that I was like, okay, so what – but I also knew I wanted to explain the variables that got us into this story. So, like, I had to figure out, well, how do I do that? So I always played around with I originally was like, oh, maybe the first – maybe instead of flashbacks, like the first – 20 minutes is going to be like just one crazy long montage and then we get into the story, or you know, I played around in my like a million times, oh, it's this or that or this or that, and I landed on that I wanted to kind of go back and forth. I knew it was a risk because I knew that some people would be like checking out, like I don't know what's happening anymore, I don't know why they right. but I knew that it was the only way I really, at the end, I knew it was the only way I could tell that specific story, you know, for what it was.
Well, it's on my favorite streaming platform, Tubi, so I recommend everybody see that. The other movie, another movie I'm really interested in. Now, when did you start directing? I mean, you just always had that vision?
No. I left. I lived in Tampa, Florida, high school, graduated high school, went to New York for film school. On my way up to New York, I'm like, oh, I'm going to be a director, writer, you know. I had written scripts way back into my adolescent years. Mm-hmm. So I always wrote. But I was like, I'm going to be a director. I love Spike Lee. I had like Stanley Kubrick, Spike Lee, where, you know, people like that. And so I was like, I'm going to be a director. Got to New York film school. And one of the first projects we did, the teacher was like, we need a cinematographer. My friend was the director on this project. And I was like, I'll do it. What do I do? You know, and the teacher showed me and I was like, this is freaking awesome. I fell in love with it. I never had that. Lighting this, it was like a party scene and I lit it and I was shooting and I was like, this is like the greatest feeling ever. And so I was like, that was it. I mean, I never turned back from that moment, but I didn't even know, I had no idea what a cinematographer, director of photography was right. When I got to film school. I was like, what is that? I don't know that, you know.
But apparently your wife turned you on to the La Llorona story.
Yeah.
And you had a script going before there were 10 movies about it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately that was abandoned.
Way back, yeah.
Yeah.
We did it. It's called Sleepover.
Oh, okay.
It's I'm proud of it from the standpoint. I mean, you know, it's a flawed movie, not gonna lie. Mm-hmm. We did it, me and another guy named Colin, the two Collins, we together and we just I love the Blair Witch. I know it's a controversial opinion. Mm-hmm. And when the Blair Witch came out, I just fell in love with the marketing, and then I saw the film and I just thought that I was like, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen, like mm-hmm. to just throw something like that together and to pretend that this was real and all. Anyway, so I was always inspired by some of the notions or some of the ideas that were brought up in the Blair Witch in terms of how to make horror work. Mm-hmm. I feel like the genre has gotten way out of control with the point of view thing, but that first one, or at least one of the first ones with the Blair Witch, I just always thought it was interesting. I was like, how can you just sort of like hold the audience in this state of absolute panic and fear as long as humanly possible? And so that's what the first La Llorona movie, it's called Sleepover.
Sleepover.
And the idea was to sort of, we literally rigged a camera to this teenage girl's head and the actress.
Right.
And just the whole movie's supposed to be like her eyes seeing the world. And basically La Llorona invades the house and tries to kill them and kill them.
That's cool. Well, thanks for spoiling it, but that's cool. Very cinematographer movie. And when all these other La Llorona movies came out, were you like, damn it?
Yeah. You know, I never, my wife turned me on to the idea. I never heard of it. I didn't grow up hearing that story.
Right.
And I was like, that's amazing. I literally was like, I'm amazed I haven't done this. And there was, I think, a movie in the 70s, I believe, something like that. Yeah, from Mexico, though.
And and before we go, could you tell me about the Mummy Murders? That's what we're really here to talk about. I'm looking forward to that. I saw the preview, and I really liked it.
Yeah, the Mummy Murders is my newest film. It's coming out. It's a serial killer movie, kind of as someone who saw it recently kind of said, silence. They got a Silence of the Lambs vibe, which was a huge deal to me because I love that film. It's kind of like, I put it this way, it's an independent film about what would you do if you were met, you had a surprise meeting at a cafe with a famous serial killer who just sat at your table and decided he wanted to tell you his life story.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
Very true crime, very timely.
Yeah, it came out of like, I don't know if you guys probably have, but like what, like they had Netflix had put out that Ted Bundy thing where it was like takes of him talking to a therapist, I believe, or something like that. So it just sort of like, I was like, oh, that's interesting. But the only things I've ever seen were that it was always like a therapist or an agent or a cop or someone talking to. And I was like, well, what if it wasn't, after incarceration, what it was like before incarceration? And this person was on the loose and like basically like went to a news reporter and was like, I'm going to tell you the story of your lifetime. Boom, you know.
Right.
That's and very how, cool.
And how did Gravitas Veritas pick it up?
So I just submitted it. It was the first time I've ever taken one of my movies and directly submitted it to a place, because normally I do the festival thing first. Mm-hmm. But I was a little bit like, you know what? I know the niche market here. I know the market I want to go for is horror fans, obviously. So I was like, I'm not really worried about festivals. I was like, I want to just get it out there because I really believe in the film. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very, like you guys, like your reactions. I wrote it. I just want to say I co-wrote it with an amazing writer named Bill William Donahue. Sorry, not Bill. William Donahue out of San Antonio, Texas. He's incredible. And he
William, don't call him Bill Donahue.
Yeah. Do not call him that. No, I don't know. He might not mind Bill. But he, William sort of like, I came up with the sort of general idea, and William sort of like created the Mummy Murderer. That's his name, obviously. At least the newspaper name they gave him.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, it was a labor of love.
I look forward to seeing it. I saw the preview. I'm going to forward the preview on to Nicole. And I wish my and by the way, speaking of horrors, I paid the back month that I owed Zoom, and they still have not upgraded me back to pro. So it's a very short show. But Colin, you have been great. Hope to have you back soon. When the movie comes out, we definitely will have you back.
Please do. Thank you both so much.